Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Peter Bregan, and I'm delighted to be with you again on a pre-recorded show today, because as you're listening to this, I'm in the middle of our conference in Syracuse, New York, on ADHD and kids and better approaches. And by the way, you do have the opportunity to just come to Thursday, which is tomorrow if you happen to be local. And that's the day I'll be emceeing the conference. And Bob Whitaker and a whole bunch of wonderful people will be interacting with me and making presentations tomorrow, and that's on the 30th. I also want to remind you that we have put an advanced sale. You can buy in advance my new book on guilt, shame, and anxiety. Subtitles, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. We've got a nice little ad on the website. We've been perking up my website. It looks a lot better. We've got social media buttons on it now and just catching up a little bit to modern times. It really looks nice. And it's got a really nice ad for the book and a description of the book and some marvelous endorsements. And we're making a really substantial offer if you order before the book comes out, which is December 4. And the book will be mailed to you sometime in early December. And the offer is that you get the book for its regular price, $19, plus you get the antidepressant fact book, which is itself a book, I think, $15 or $16 for sale. So it's like really is a two books, almost a complete two books for one. I really want to get the Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety book out. It has a whole new theory about the origins of guilt, shame, and anxiety in evolution, why we evolved to have these feelings, how they work in childhood, why natural selection endowed us with these miserable, painful, suppressive feelings, and how we can overcome them. And it is a genuinely new theory I call the negative legacy emotions. These are negative legacy emotions from both evolution and childhood. Guilt, shame, and anxiety are primitive. They're even prehistoric in two ways. Guilt, shame, and anxiety are prehistoric as they evolved in evolution, and they're prehistoric because in childhood, when they're stimulated again and elicited from our genetic makeup, as they are in every culture, when they're elicited before we can understand what's happening and most of the time before we can remember what's happening, which makes them even prehistoric in our own lifetimes. And this is a new way of looking at this that liberates us from these suppressive emotions, and I'm going to explain in the book why we have them, what the attempt is by natural selection, what problem it was trying to solve, but it doesn't really solve our adult mature problems of making decisions. Guilt, shame, and anxiety get in the way. And that's a real thumbnail of a whole new approach. And it's relevant to my guest today, Kim Olver. Her last name is spelled O-L-V-E-R, because Kim just had me talk with her for an hour. She interviewed me a couple of weeks ago for the William Glasser Institute's summit. And we had a wonderful hour talking about guilt, shame, and anxiety in my book, as it turned out, a good part of the time. And Kim was a great listener. She's a psychotherapist. She's the author of Secrets of Happy Couples, Secrets of Happy Couples. And she's the executive director of the William Glasser International. Bill Glasser, I'm proud to say, was a dear friend of mine, and he's gone now. Kim is an LCPC and a BCC, but most of all, I really believe this person would be a really marvelous therapist because she was really good with me when she interviewed me. Hi, Kim.
Hi, Peter. It's good to be here.
You want to tell folks a little bit about your summit and when the tapes, including the hour I did with you, are going to be available?
Sure. This was such a labor of love. We invited speakers that we believe have like minds to Bill Glasser, whose theory is that people have choices and we don't have to be trapped by diagnoses or history or past or things that have happened to us. And we want to get the word out to the everyday person about how they can improve their state of mental health and happiness. And as you talked about in your interview, it was really about living their best life and loving life and being in a state of life of love, living by good principles. And we invited 24 speakers to speak over the 24-hour period of World Mental Health Day, which was October 10th. And we had 1,200 people who signed up to listen, and we have even more. They're still signing up to be able to listen to the interviews. And what we did was we extracted the audio from these visual interviews so people could actually have them for portable listening. They could download them to their iPods, their iPads, their tablets, and take them with them in the car or, you know, to the gym when they work out. So they have some good positive information on how to live their best life. I hope that's going to be available this weekend, but we're still working out some of the details, so it may not be until early next week, but it will be very soon.
Good, and I'll be able to put that up on my YouTube, which will be my talk, and that'll be a good thing. It was a really great interview that you did. You told me that mine was one of the most listened to. I want to put that in just for the fun of it.
It is, still.
Thank you. Where would you like to take today? What do you have on your mind right now? You're a person of tremendous experience and empathy, and you know, you come from this great background with Bill. Where would you like to begin today? Want to just tell people about Bill?
Well, I feel a little humbled talking about this great man, but I will share some of Dr. Glasser's life and work. And I came to reality therapy in 1987 when I worked for a foster care agency that used Dr. Glasser's work as their philosophical base. And I actually chose that job because of the exposure to reality therapy, which at that time I knew absolutely nothing about. I had graduated with a degree in psychology and never heard of reality therapy. So I was interested. I wanted to find out more about it. And when I had my first training, the basic intensive training with Dr. Nancy Buck, I remember thinking, I want to be her when I grow up because I just loved her energy. I loved the information. She was traveling around the country teaching other people these great ideas. And for me, at that time, I had what my professors would call an eclectic approach. And that was the approach that we were encouraged to have. And I know their intention was that we could be versatile and use all different kinds of theories and different kinds of places with different types of clients. But what I really felt like was I was just flying by the seat of my pants and really didn't know what I was doing. So when I learned choice theory, it gave me a map, if you will, a theory of human behavior. So if I tried something in therapy and it didn't yield the results I had hoped for, then I knew how to go back to the theory to try to figure out what might be the next step to take. So I never felt at a loss for where to go next. The theory really informs what to do when you're struggling with what to do. And working with specialized foster kids, it was challenging sometimes because these were children, you know, who had been exposed to some really rough things in their early lives. And I wanted to help, but I seemed a little inadequate, not well enough prepared to really have an impact. And choice theory really helped me with that. It taught me to focus on the relationship that I developed with my clients, that was really one of the most important things, and to try to connect with my clients in a way that was absent any kind of external control, meaning that I wasn't trying to push them in any particular direction. I worked really hard. It was harder in the beginning. It's become very easy for me now, but that was a long journey of being able to sit with a client and not have in my own head what I thought they should do. It was really about respecting my client's ability to choose the best path for them when they had the information they needed to make an informed decision, and respecting that decision. That was instrumental for me in being able to be more effective with my clients.
Tell me how you address your clients in regard to choice theory. Can you give an example of a little bit of a conversation that might take place? Go ahead.
Sure. In the beginning, it really is a lot of psychoeducation. So it's really helping people understand that they do have choice, and that our behavior, any behavior that we engage in, is purposeful. We don't do anything for no reason. Every behavior that we use is our best attempt at that point in time to get something that we want. We may not even be aware ourselves consciously of why we're doing it, but it is a behavior that we've created to help move us in the direction of something that's going to help us. Even if it looks dysfunctional to the outside world, it's something that we believe is our best option at that point in time. The reason that that's so important, this is a conversation that I'll have with clients. I'm not trying to blame my client for any behaviors that they've chosen, because they've done absolutely the best they knew how to do. But I do want them to understand that because they've created this behavior, they're very empowered and capable of creating a different behavior if they want to. It's kind of similar to what you spoke about when we were doing our interview a couple of weeks ago, when you talked about you can experience guilt, shame, and anxiety, but you don't have to believe those feelings. You don't have to take them personally and actually become guilt, shame, and anxiety. You can recognize them and say, oh, there you are, old friend. I know who you are, and I don't need to give you any more value or importance than I decide to. So that's the power of understanding the true meaning of choice in your life.
You put that really, really well. One of the ways that I also think about it, and I've definitely been influenced, by William Glasser in this regard. He and I are somewhat similar in age. He's a bit older than me when he passed, and I had been reading some of even earlier people who talked about moral psychology and people making choices, but Bill really laid that issue out with extreme clarity. And one of the ways I interpret the problem is that people feel overwhelmed with helplessness when they're at their worst, when they're in their deepest, most disturbed state, whether they're just immobilized or paralyzed or acting bizarrely or, laying in bed and not moving, and that it's a continuum of helplessness which we can only overcome by choosing our way out of it, by deciding, I don't want to be this way anymore. I know I feel like it's my only way or the best way. Nobody feels it's the best way. My only way. I have no choice.
Right.
It's a feeling. It overcomes me. I'm overwhelmed. And I actually help people, and I'm talking now about people having a lot of trouble, help them piece by piece work their way out of the helpless position. And almost invariably, something in their childhood, their background, their upbringing, discouraged them from feeling they could do that they had any other choice but to lapse into helplessness as their default position. And something in their childhood, a whole array of things usually, kept them from thinking they could make choices to advance their lives. resonate with what your experience is?
I completely agree with that, and I also believe that there is a cultural, societal component to that as well, in terms of you label someone with a diagnosis and you say, well, you're bipolar or you're schizophrenic or you have clinical depression, and people then think, oh, that explains it. And now it's like they've accepted that's who they are and there's nothing they can do, or they're prescribed a medication and you know, they take the medication as if that's their only choice or option. And it really victimizes people. They get into a place where they do feel helpless and believe there's what can I do? There's nothing I can do. I have this thing, whatever this thing is, and I'm stuck. And I'm going to be this way the rest of my life. And nothing brings me more pain than hearing someone say that they're stuck and there's nothing they can do, because there's always something a person can do, even if it's just a tiny thing that they could do different today that they can build on tomorrow. It's one little step in a positive direction. And I do know that can be very, very hard for people. It's like, you know, they might feel like they're being held back by a million hands trying to keep them from moving forward, but they can move forward if they want to and if that's the path that they want to take. And most people, as Dr. Glasser said, there's very few people who will continue to choose misery once they realize that it's a choice.
Yeah, this is I love this conversation. I think it's right on point about some of the most important, literally, aspects of life, some of the most important aspects of life. I'm so glad you brought up the diagnoses and the drugs, because now I'm beginning to see people not only in their 20s and 30s, but in their 40s, who were begun on drugs sometimes as early as their teens or younger, sometimes
right.
7, 8, 4, 5, whatever. I mean, there's almost no down limit now on when we might drug an infant. And these folks have grown up in this whole societal, cultural, medical environment, literally thinking they have no choice about their feelings. They can't learn to control them. They can't learn to react differently to them. That a feeling has to be manipulated with a drug because it's biochemical. It's utterly devastating to the human spirit to do this. And of course, it's literally swelling the roles of disability now. The great rise in disability over the last few years has been people on psychiatric drugs who think they can't ever really take charge of their lives. It's such a sad thing to view human beings in this objectified, mechanical way, and to have them then view themselves in this way. And people learn that if they just show enough helplessness, they'll get a new drug.
Right.
They'll get some more diagnoses, and they don't understand what a downhill course it is. But people can learn. You know, I've seen people turn it completely around. For me, the combination of that all negative emotions lead us to be helpless. That's a part of the theory of the negative legacy emotions, is that guilt, shame, and anxiety, and then chronic anger and numbness, which come from them, chronic anger. So guilt, shame, and anxiety, and chronic anger and numbness, underlying them is helplessness. And their purpose, I'll get to what I view their purpose as, their purpose from natural selection is to suppress our willfulness within the family unit. So we were such a violent creature as we evolved, and yet so social and so loving of intimacy, that we would have torn each other apart, just like we learned to tear huge animals apart and other people apart and other human lines, that we learned to attack strangers. You know, we had so much violence directed outward that there had to be a way to prevent that violence inward on both the part of the children and the adults taking care of the children. And my view is that guilt, shame, and anxiety were selected through evolution so that people survived better and reproduced better and had communities better if they were by and large suppressed by inhibitory emotions in their personal relationships, but that this suppression is so primitive that it continues throughout adulthood and doesn't allow for full, mature decision-making. And that's where the choice theory comes in, decision-making based on higher ideals and higher principles. I talk a lot about the underlying helplessness and its relationship to choosing your way out of that.
Right. I loved what you said in your interview about, you know, not taking it personally and not, you know, not giving it any more importance than you need to. Understand where it came from, why you have it, and choose a different way of thinking that would lead to a different emotion.
Yeah. Tell us, Kim, where do you live and work, and what you have a practice?
I have a very small practice because most of what I do is public speaking. So,
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I travel all over and I speak to various groups. I'm one of the cadre of speakers that speaks to our military veterans when they return from combat. I do a lot of training in choice theory and reality therapy. I do workshops on parenting and couple kinds of relationships. I do workshops. I just did one yesterday for Cook County Probation on stress management and anger management. So, you know, I do a lot of things. Everything I do has choice theory as its base. People, you know, they see the wide array of things that I do and they think you're all over the place. And really, I believe that choice theory has application to pretty much every human interaction that we have. So my expertise is in choice theory, and I apply it to a lot of different areas. And so I live in Chicago. My family, my two sons, their wives, my grandchildren, they live in Northeast Pennsylvania. So I go back there quite a bit to spend time with them. And then I'm, you know,
How far is that from Ithaca? Maybe you could come up and visit us.
It isn't very far from Ithaca. I'm thinking that Binghamton is about an hour and a half, so Ithaca's not very far from there.
No, that'd be great to get together at some point. So, by the way, again, folks, we're talking with Kim Olver. Am I pronouncing your name right, Kim?
It's Olver, like I don't even know, Olver.
Olver.
Olver, yeah, right.
O-L-V-E-R.
Right. It's Oliver without the I.
Yeah, O-L-V-E-R. And I think we got you on the web pretty easily with your name, right? Or is there an address you want to give on the web?
You can find me with my name, but the main website for the William Glasser Institute is wglasserinternational.org. My personal website is therelationshipcenter.biz, B-I-Z. And that's my personal website where I, you know, help people work with people on, you know, whatever it is that they are struggling with.
Well, I'd love to hear you talk about maybe just how you would begin. I've never asked one of my guests to do this before, but I would love to hear you just make one of your starting presentations for maybe 10 minutes to a group of people, maybe like the last group you spoke to. Would you like to do that, give people a sample of of how you go about introducing these ideas? Is that the
Sure. I mean, it's fresh in my mind from yesterday, and I usually grab people's attention with a pretty shocking statement in the beginning. So yesterday I talked about stress management and anger management, and I was talking with, you know, Cook County, so you're talking Chicago, probation officers. So I'm pretty sure that they have a little bit of stress in their life. And so I'll start by saying, okay, today we're going to talk about stress. Have you all experienced any stress in the last year? And everybody's hand goes up. How about the last month? Everybody's hand goes up. How about this week? Everybody's hand goes up. And how about today? Anybody feeling stressed today? And not everybody, but a lot of people put their hands up. And then I go to the next slide and I'll say, how many of you believe that stress is a choice? Oh my gosh. People don't want to hear that. They don't want to think about stress being a choice. They think it's something that happens to them. And I distinguish between stressors, which are the things that happen that we truly have no choice over. We can't control whether there's a hurricane that kills people we love or takes our home away and all of our belongings. We can't control when someone we love dies. We can't control when our child grows up and moves away. They're all stressors that we don't choose. But we do choose how we manage those stressors. And kind of similar, I think, maybe, to what you talk about with guilt, shame, and anxiety, I talk about how stress has a purpose. It serves a purpose that can be helpful. We talked about, you know, procrastinators, and I'm one of those people. And if you give me a project to do 6 months out, I won't be very focused or able to do much on that project until it gets about a month out. And that's because when I create stress by shortening the deadline, I develop more of a laser-like focus, and I'm able to be much more productive in that shorter time frame. Not everybody is like that, but stress in that situation helps me be more productive. I also remember when I worked at an agency, I had a boss, and you know, it was that foster care agency where, you know, you got stress all the time. You're dealing with kids who have been through such horrific things, and then you have foster parents who say, you know, I can't work with this child anymore, and you've got to scramble and find a home for him. So there's all of this stress, and there were times when I felt overwhelmed, and I stressed. This is the behavior. This is the choice in stressing. I emitted a behavior of stress so that my boss would get the message, don't give me one more thing right now or I'm gonna crack. And she would get the message, and she would give me the space I needed to regroup and catch up with myself. That's another purpose or benefit from stress. Another benefit might be you get some attention or you get some help. People around you see, oh my gosh, you look really overwhelmed. Let me help you. So once people understand that their stress is not just all bad, there's actually a purpose for it, there's a benefit for it, there's a reason you might choose it, then they begin to understand that they could choose differently if they want to. And so then we talked about some of the things that could be done to mitigate some of the effects of stress. And one of the things I talked about was irrational beliefs. And I'll ask, you know, is there anyone in the room that doesn't have any? And this one woman in the room of 40 people raised her hand, and I said, well, that's the biggest irrational belief of all. We all have them. And I shared some of mine. It took me 50 years to figure out it was irrational, but I really believed that everyone I met should like me. I'm a likable person. If you don't like me, obviously there's something wrong. I have to fix it. We talked about what irrational beliefs are, and some of the irrational beliefs might be, children must obey their parents. And the reason it's irrational is because children don't always do that. So when you see a child who is disrespecting their parent, your stress level goes on the rise. Even though they're not your child, it has nothing to do with you, but you're holding on to an irrational belief. So I ask people, it's okay to hold on to the thought that you prefer that children show respect to their parents, but change it from that absolute must to a preference, and your stress level will be mitigated some. The other thing I talk about is the stories that we tell ourselves. We tell ourselves stories every day. We can't know what's in another person's mind, but we try to make sense of what's going on in our life. So we'll tell ourselves stories. We'll believe things. I say good morning and somebody doesn't say good morning back, I tell myself the story. How rude are they? How disrespectful? What's wrong with them? I get into a whole thing that may or may not be true. They might have had earphones in their ear and not even heard me. They might have been introspective, thinking about a fight that they just had with their child before they came to work. It could have been anything, but the story I tell myself raises my level of stress. So I talk about, you're the author. You're writing this story. Change it. Write a different story. Write a story that helps you feel better instead of a story that brings you pain, stress, negative emotions. Write something that helps you feel better. And so, you know, some people laugh at that. They think I'm making a joke. I'm not making a joke at all. I think the power that we have in our brains to change our thinking can truly change our lives. And so that's maybe 10 minutes of what we talked about yesterday.
Well, it makes a lot of sense to me. Now, did Bill Glasser talk about changing ideas the way you are? I like the way you do it. It's got, I guess we would call it cognitive therapy if we were going to put a label on it. But I do it a lot with folks too. I try to help them see what I call their self-defeating ideas are. The ideas that just aren't going to work. And one way I look at them is that we usually develop these ideas in childhood. Like you developed in childhood the idea that everybody had to like you. You may have had some input from your mother or father or big brother or sister or teachers or a religious school or whatever, you know, to encourage you to think everybody should like you. And that idea sort of got you somewhere in elementary school and high school because you got a lot of people to like you. But then in adulthood, it runs into serious problems when you want to get something important done. Or you want to stand up for an important principle or do something like a lot of the work I do where a lot of people are going to feel offended or angry at you. You have to let go of that kind of concept as an adult.
Yeah, it took me a while, but I finally got there.
So I like that idea that these are self-defeating ideas in adulthood, but they probably worked, as you said, and I like that. We develop our ideas for a reason and for a purpose, and our behaviors for a reason and a purpose. And the ones that maybe we had to develop in childhood, for example, submissiveness if you've been badly abused,
yeah.
Or a lot of anger if maybe that kept one of your parents at bay or your big brother at bay or something like that. But these things that you developed that may have worked in childhood, at least you thought they were working in childhood, that there's almost always some modification that has to be made of our childhood ideas when we get into adulthood. And that sounds completely consistent with the way your thinking is going as well.
Yes, and I would even say not always childhood. I think in some of the work that I do with the military, they're trained to be angry. You can't go into battle where you're going to be asked to kill people unless you're angry. You can't go into battle feeling good and happy and accomplish your mission. So then when they come home, that's when that belief no longer serves them. They may still be feeling angry, and they've got their children, and they've got their spouses, and they've got their community around them, people at work, and it's hard to flip that switch. But it's been pretty heavily installed, and for a good reason. They wouldn't have survived what they had to do had they not had that behavior. But now they have to choose something different if they want to reintegrate, and have, good, cohesive, healthy relationships.
Yeah, that whole theory applies to, of course, post-traumatic stress,
mm-hmm.
which is you're having all the reactions that served you well in battle or seemed to, the hyper alert, the looking at all the roofs around you, a certain degree of paranoia, but ability to unleash violence at a moment's notice and so on. All those reactions that you developed during this combat stress are perfectly suited to that. They may have gotten exaggerated and even become a problem then, but they certainly evolve out of that experience. And then you come home and you're supposed to play with your children and hug your wife.
Right.
Or your husband, because there's women too.
That's right.
In active combat now. And it's very interesting to me how much Glasser's approach and my approach sort of complement each other and go together. When I first met Bill, it was very much like that. He gave me a wonderful introduction. I gave a talk at one of his conferences.
I was there.
Were you there for that?
I was there, yes.
Was
I
that
was.
In Canada? Where was that?
I don't remember where it was, but I definitely remember.
I definitely remember.
I remember you specifically talking about a study that was done with kids and ADHD and Ritalin, and how they, the pharmaceutical companies were using this study to say that kids with ADHD had different brains than kids who didn't. And what they failed to account for was every subject in their study had been on Ritalin. So could it have been the Ritalin that caused the change in the brain and not the ADHD? And it was just brilliant and something that the average layperson would never consider. They wouldn't know to even ask that question. So it made quite an impression on me then.
The data is coming in now, too, you know, as we follow these people into their 40s. Not we. The original abusers are following these people into their 40s, and they've been virtually destroyed because they developed whole careers as mental patients, these innocent 7-year-olds and 6-year-olds, and they went from one drug to another, that entire process we talked about earlier in the show, and then they end up with atrophy of the brain, shrinkage of the brain from so many toxins over the years. Their whole quality of lives are lower than the control group of other kids who didn't get the drugs who were followed from the same period of time. And just in every way, criminality, mental hospitalization, suicide, their lives are worse. And they're still claiming it's because they were a little hyperactive when they were children rather than saying the honest truth, which is they ended up with career mental patients and have been on drugs ever since. And they're high obesity from being on the new antipsychotics, earlier death from being on the antipsychotics, because that's the final common pathway of destruction via psychiatry. It's a lot to think about.
Yes.
Jim, tell us some more. I mean, I'm really interested in giving you first of all, I love talking with you, and I love talking about myself with you, because I talk about myself much more with you on the show today than usual, because it's just a comfort zone for me of being with you, though we've never met. But talk more about yourself and maybe other groups you teach. Do you work with children?
Well, I did a lot of work with children, of course, when I worked at the foster care agency. I don't work with children anymore. Most of what I do now is actually life coaching so that I can maintain a practice while I'm on the road. And I talk with people over the phone. A lot of the work that I do is with people trying to find their way in relationships, whether it's their relationship with themselves or relationships with important other people. Some are recovering from a breakup. There's some grief and loss work that I do. And I really love the work I do with grief and loss because, of course, I've been through some grief of my own. My husband passed away in 1999. He was 37. He had leukemia for 5 years. We have 2 sons at that time. We're 13 and 15. And probably one of the most difficult things in my life. The most difficult thing so far is when my baby boy, who was almost 18, signed up for the Army to himself go fight in Iraq. That was even harder. But, you know, when my husband was sick and dying and eventually...
May I ask if he came out okay?
My son, yeah, he really has. He did 2 tours in Iraq. He's not unscarred. I mean, that would be
nobody.
That would not be a fair assessment. And he did. He was exposed to a lot of negative things. He has yet to share with me, but I know on the 4th of July he avoids fireworks, things like that. They cause him some anxiety even still. But he came home and. The first time he came home, he went through a big period of drinking, which, you know, I saw a lot of soldiers do when they come home. It's, you know, self-medicating.
Yeah.
Then he went back, and when he came back the second time, I really believe the thing that helped him the most was the strong relationship he had with his girlfriend. And he ended up marrying her, and they have 2 children, and he's the best dad. And it's just a joy to see the man that he's become. He's 29 years old next month, and he's just truly a joy to be around. So I had a bit at one period of time when my husband got sick, then he died, and then I'm raising teenage boys, angry teenage boys, no less, by myself. So those three things were things that choice theory really helped me with, because I knew a lot that was happening was not in my control. And I knew I was going to grieve the loss of my husband for sure, but I didn't want to get stuck in that grief because I knew I had to be, you know, a kind of a guide for my children on how to get through it. And so some of the grief work I do is based on some work that I read by John DeMartini in The Breakthrough Experience, and he talks about a balance sheet. And I found this so helpful to me. I came across this idea when my husband was sick. And what he talked about was, of all things, the periodic table of elements and how every element in our natural universe has equal protons and electrons. You know, I can't tell you which element has how many, but, you know, if it has 14 protons, it has 14 electrons. It's perfectly balanced. And so he extrapolated from that that our life experiences are similarly perfectly balanced. But unfortunately, we only see one side. We either see the positive side or the negative side, and we lose the balance of our experiences. So I immediately went on a search, if you will, for the positive of my husband being sick and dying. And that almost sounds cold-hearted, but I thought I needed to find something that I could kind of hang my hat on and help my children to hang their hats on so that they could move through this period of grief maybe better or, you know, than they would have otherwise. So immediately the two things that I found were we had the opportunity to say goodbye, which is so much more than many people have. We had the opportunity to make sure our relationship was in order. There was nothing left unsaid. We were just very loving with each other and the kids, and that was a gift. And the other thing that was really major was that my husband, the chemical benzene was connected to the type of leukemia my husband had, and he was a mechanic who worked with benzene. So when he learned that, he stopped working, even though he wasn't yet sick enough not to work. So before he got sick, my husband was a workaholic. He would go to work at 7 in the morning, and he'd come home at 9 o'clock at night, dirty, tired, you know, and not have a lot of energy for our family. But once he quit his job, he spent more time with my boys than he would have had he been healthy and lived to be 100. So that was another gift. And, you know, in hindsight, it's always easy to find those gifts and the opportunities. You know, you get fired from work, and then 10 years later, you realize, well, that's the thing that helped me start my own business, so thank you for firing me. But the idea is to try to find those. I call it the glow now, and it's the gift, the lesson, the opportunity in those painful events. And when you can find the balance and you can add enough positive that it equals the pain, doesn't take the pain away, but it helps you navigate that with a more balanced view and a more accepting view. And I've found that it can really be helpful getting people through the grief process a little faster if they want to. I'm always very respectful of where they are. Some people don't want to let go of their grief. It's something that is helping them. It's something that helps them keep that person alive and active in their perception. And, you know, they're not ready. And I'm never would push somebody towards that. But when they're ready, it's something that I found has really helped every person who's tried to go through that process. So I like doing the grief work, whether it's because of a death or if it's just, you know, someone chose, I don't want to be with you anymore. There's still grief work that people go through anytime they experience a loss. So that's another thing that I really enjoy doing.
Yeah, the older I get, the more apparent it is to me that life is about our social relationships.
Yes.
You know, we can achieve fame or fortune or do work we're proud of, but genuine happiness, as much as human beings are allowed to find it, comes through loving relationships. And since they're so important to us and they become such a part of us, there is no way to lose them without suffering. There's that balance issue. I mean, if people are going to mean that much to us, other people, then the loss of them is going to mean a great deal to us as well.
Absolutely.
And that's this rich tapestry of life that's inescapable. And if you try to escape the pain of relationship, which is very tempting to do, and which I on and off did a great deal until Ginger came into my life, you keep trying to avoid that pain of relationship, you just end up with terrible pain of a different kind.
That's right. It's there. You have to honor it. I love, you know, there's a quote by Dr. Seuss, of all people, and I love this quote, and it he said, don't cry because it's over. Smile because it happened. And it's you know, recognizing you wouldn't be in so much pain if this person wasn't such a positive force in your life. So be grateful and give thanks for the time that you had with that person. It can help. It doesn't take the pain away by any means. But switching your focus from the loss to the gift can really help mitigate the effects of long-term grief.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we really matter to each other.
That's right.
Tell me some about the William Glasser International. I know at the time he was alive, there were conferences that would go on around the world and other activities. Is there much going on now with the William Glasser International, and are people holding conferences around Glasser's principles? Are there training programs around his principles?
Yes, absolutely. There's training going on all over the world. We have people in 43 countries. We just did an international conference. Our international conferences are every other year. And this year, in July, it was in Toronto. So the next conference in 2016 is going to be in Korea. And because there's now an international body, William Glasser International, the U.S. has its own institute. So now the U.S. has an institute called William Glasser Institute U.S., and they have conferences in the years when there is no international conference. So in 2015, WGI U.S. will have a conference in Las Vegas. And we do, you know, we move them all over the country to allow different groups to be able to attend, you know, because it's closer to them as opposed to the long-distance travel. But I find, especially with the advances that have been made in neuroscience and neuropsychology, that the evidence is very supportive of the work that Dr. Glasser began in the 60s and 70s. There's a lot of evidence now for, you know, the connection, the mind-body connection, the fact that, you know, when you think different thoughts, it lights up different parts of your brain, all kinds of things that really support the work that Dr. Glasser began, just intuitively knew without these tests that could show the validity of his thinking. So there's a lot of people who are recognizing in the 70s and 80s, there were people who thought, you know, that Dr. Glasser, he's way out there. He thinks there's no such thing as mental illness, that people choose to be sick. And, you know, he really got a bad rap from a lot of people because he stood, as you do, separate and apart from that medical model thinking of psychiatric diagnoses and medication. But the tide, I think, is starting to turn. And I really hope that it turns in a big way where people understand that there have been lots of lies perpetrated in the name of psychiatry and mental health, and people can get help. It may be harder to work through some problems than it is to take a pill, but the long-term benefit is way better when you actually address what the problem is underlying, as opposed to just trying to mask some of the symptoms with the medication.
Yeah, I don't think Bill ever advocated medication in his entire career, did he?
Once I heard him say that he was a board-certified psychiatrist since 1957 and never once prescribed psychotropic medication for a patient. and said he never would. And his thinking on that was he would never take it himself. He wouldn't ask a family member to take it, so why would he prescribe it for a client of his? Now, he also wasn't a person who would say somebody comes to him and is on medication and he'd immediately take them off medication because, as you know, that's pretty risky to just cold turkey stop psychotropic medication. So, you know, he didn't take that kind of strong stance with people. But he did work with people on what relationship in their life wasn't working for them and try to help them reconnect with the important people in their lives or develop their very first relationship, healthy relationship with someone. And those relationships were really the thing that could help people get the strength to choose to do some things differently.
It's a pleasure talking with you. We have a few minutes left. I'm talking with Kim Olver, O-L-V-E-R. Kim is the executive director of the William Glasser International. She is a therapist and a coach, a life coach. And she does speaking and is available for speaking to all kinds of groups in all kinds of places. And is somebody that I think that my listeners might be very interested in inviting to address their own group. I was interested in your use of the term coach. I find myself, here I am a psychiatrist, all this training and all the authority and all that. I find myself increasingly telling my patients or my clients that I'm their coach. I'm coaching them.
Yes.
It's so funny. It just seems to be happening more and more. I'm coaching you to let go of the helplessness and to see that you can take charge of your life. I'm coaching you to actually fulfill your own ideals and your own self-interest and coaching you to have a more loving life. And just more and more, it seems to me that that's a more appropriate term than therapist, which has an aura around it of authority that I don't think exists. It still implies a kind of a medical specialty. And it's not occurred to me before this moment, but maybe eventually the big advance will be that we all admit we're coaches and we figure out what kind of coach we are and we advertise ourselves as a particular kind of a coach who's, you know, offering a particular approach. Parting thoughts, Kim, we have a few minutes. What have you learned from your very rich life and the loss of your husband and your son going to war and raising your kids? What do you think life's all about? How's that? Never asked anybody that at the
Wow, end of the day. That's a big question, Peter.
What's life all about?
I don't really know what life is all about for everyone, but I know what life is about for me. And I would say that life is about taking responsibility for my life and giving the gift of allowing others to have responsibility for theirs. My son said it to me once, and I think this might have been one of the proudest moments of my life. He said he was talking to his wife, and he said, "You know the difference between my mom and your mom?" And she said, "What?" And he said, "Well, your mom tells us what to do, and my mom makes suggestions." And I thought, that is truly what I want to do. I don't ever want to feel like I am making decisions or coercing or nudging or any other thing, another person, into doing something that I believe that they should or should not do. That's not my right. It's not my business. My main business is to make those decisions for myself. And if I pay attention to that, I won't have time to be thinking about what other people ought to do. I'll be focused on what I'm going to do next. And I think for me that focus and shift, and really it's been a journey to take. I wouldn't say that I'm there yet, but I definitely am more aware of that. And for me, that's what my life is about.
You're such a gentle creature. I wonder if I'm a little more directive. I don't know. I mean, I will tell folks, listen, this helpless behavior is just destroying you and your family, and you really can take charge of that, and I want to help you take charge of that. So that's a, you know, I give pretty, in that sense, pretty direct instructions at times. Would you do that, or would you find a more invitational way?
I think that my way is more to use questioning, and that's, you know, that's what Bill taught us in reality therapy, is to ask the question, what do you want? What are you doing to get there? Is there anything you're doing that's getting in the way? And if you keep doing it the same way, are you going to get where you want? If the answer is yes, then there's nothing more for me to do. You've got a plan. You know what you want, and what you're doing is going to get you there. Knock yourself out. Go do your thing. If the answer is no, and I would hope that, you know, if somebody's doing that helpless victim role and they want something more for themselves, they're going to recognize that's not working for them. Then I have a more directive approach with suggestions about what they might be able to try. But I know Bill, you know, taught us those questions, and I think even before Bill, it was maybe called Socratic questioning.
Right.
Just to help people come up with their answers and their truth, because I recognize my truth may not be their truth. And I can't make decisions for other people. It's not fair, because I'm not living their life. They have to live their life. So I'm for me, that's what it is. Like I said, I'm not saying that's for anybody else, but that's where I'm at with what I think my life is all about.
I'm with you 100%, and I also think we all have our styles.
That's right.
I think I'm actually more gentle and less directive on the radio. That's interesting. Than I am in therapy, where when I see somebody doing something very destructive, I kind of intervene a bit more directly, hopefully with the same tone or quality of bringing out the best in people.
Mm-hmm.
It's always a pleasure to talk with you. I want to build our relationship over time. And again, we've been talking with Kim Olver, O-L-V-E-R. She has a book, Secrets of Happy Couples. Where can people get your book? Can they get it on Amazon?
They can. It's on Amazon. It's on my website. They can go to secretsofhappycouples.com. And their local bookstore. Some bookstores carry it, but any bookstore will order it.
Thanks so much for being on the show. And let's stay in touch. And, of course, you'll be back.
I would love that. Thanks
eventually.
For having me, Peter. It's been a delight.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.